This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Ankur Desai, and at 16 hours GMT on Monday the 3rd of August, these are our main stories. The head of world football, Gianni Infantino, is coming under increasing pressure to quit after some governing bodies consider withdrawing support for his re-election as head of FIFA. Waterbombing planes are being used to help hundreds of firefighters in Greece battling wildfires on three fronts west of the capital, Athens. Japan and the US say they took coordinated action to prop up the yen last week after the Japanese currency fell to a 40-year low. Also in this podcast, the family of the detained former leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, have welcomed her being allowed to meet a delegate from the Red Cross. And...
He's completely fine. Yeah, he's amazing. Everything they did just completely reversed what could have been a really horrible start to his life.
The remarkable womb surgery which fixed a miracle baby with intestines outside its body. First, could the man in charge of world football soon lose his iron grip on the game? 2 weeks ago, standing alongside Donald Trump in New Jersey, Gianni Infantino handed the World Cup trophy to Spain after a lucrative and largely successful tournament. Since then, his position has weakened considerably after his plan to sell stakes in competitions like the World Cup to private investors had to be abandoned, following widespread condemnation from the world football community. Now UEFA, who govern the European game, have threatened legal action against that plan. And the English and Welsh football associations have signalled their withdrawal of support for Mr. Infantino and his re-election due to take place next year. Only the Confederation of African Football has remained largely silent so far, believing that it could benefit financially. So, where does this leave Gianni Infantino? Can he survive? And should he stay in his post? David Bernstein, former chair of the English Football Association, says he shouldn't.
I don't think he can survive in place, and he should not. Just to recap, this was a very, very bad deal. It was a sweetheart deal. It was done in secret. I think it was done as an undervaluation, and it was done with a very tight timetable to try and squeeze it through. Totally unacceptable. So the answer is it was excessively negative, that deal, and he has to go. What I would consider, and this is absolutely radical, and I have to say, I haven't seen anybody else come up with this idea yet, is FIFA is of huge value, and I say it could be worth $50 billion. I would think about listing it on a stock exchange, probably in the USA. In other words, floating as a public company. You could attract hundreds of thousands of fans as shareholders. You know, fans could be encouraged to put up $100 or $1,000 or $1 million, or anywhere in between, into the FIFA, become shareholders, as you would do in Apple or Microsoft and so on. And by doing so, A, you would empower to some extent, and certainly get involved with the worldwide fan base of football to invest in FIFA. And anybody I've spoken to about this, by the way, they're, oh, yes, I would love the opportunity to invest in FIFA. And then you get regular reports and accounts from them and so on. So number one, it would be democratic. And number two, you get, I think, a much higher value, which means that the countries you're talking about could get much more money than they were going to get under this deal. And thirdly, and not the least important, it would bring proper governance to FIFA. They would be subject to the sort of governance that you would get in a public company.
Tarek Panja is global sports correspondent at the New York Times. Rebecca Kesby asked him what he thought of David Bernstein's idea to put FIFA on the New York Stock Exchange.
He's not the first person to say this, and this isn't the first scandal FIFA has had. And what David was saying just takes me back to May 2015, when the Swiss authorities, acting on behalf of the Department of Justice, dragged the previous group of FIFA leaders out of luxury hotel bedrooms in Switzerland and replaced them with what we've had now, with Gianni Infantino and co. And there was talk then of this. And the reason we won't have this is because if you do a listing, you become a public company, guess what? You need to have a greater degree of transparency over your operations. And as we've seen here from these people, whether it's Sepp Blatter's period, Joao Havelange before him, and now Gianni Infantino, the light is not something that this organisation seems to enjoy. To me, it seems like FIFA is impossible to reform from within. It will require outside bodies, perhaps governments, to now take a closer look at what FIFA is.
One idea that has been doing the rounds as well, Tariq, is that maybe there could be a rotating presidency, rather in the way that you have in some political bodies like the EU, for example, whereby a country or a football association would take over the presidency for a 4 or 5 year period, I guess, to get through the next World Cup. Is that a good idea?
Yeah, that's something that I've been speaking about with people. At the moment, you have people at FIFA who think they are in a battle, and they are commercially with their confederations, for example, looking for television revenue or sponsors against UEFA, for example, whereas UEFA is also sat as a, you know, Alexander Shefferin, the president, is also a vice president of FIFA. It's kind of not fit for purpose, this system. But I think it's much bigger than all of this, really. So we're talking about FIFA today, but the entire football pyramid is full of little FIFAs, whether it is the confederations, the ones that we're, you know, really celebrating here for standing up to this, or whether it is a lot of the football associations around the world. A lot of these organisations are riven with the same problems we are seeing here in the much bigger scale with Infantino and what he's doing with this scheme. What should be happening is a bigger conversation, perhaps, of how this most popular of sports, this engine of the global sports economy, is actually run, whether at a regional level or at the FIFA level, because you change something at FIFA, but, you know, the UEFA model is almost exactly the same.
And, I mean, briefly, we hear that UEFA's threatening legal action as well now. Are fans losing faith in the game because of all of this?
No, I think what we've seen is the game is so strong, it's so powerful, and because we've just had this World Cup and the passions that it stirred, the billions of people that watched either all over the world and the millions that came to the stadiums. And that is why, in a way, these people can get away with it, because whatever they do to try and damage it, the sport has such a powerful hold over society that people just keep coming back for more.
Tariq Panja there. And we have more on Gianni Infantino's chances of survival on our YouTube channel. Search for BBC News on YouTube and you'll find Global News Podcast in the podcast section. There's a new story available every weekday. There are moments when nature and the intensity of weather surpass any human planning or operational capability. The words of the Prime Minister of Greece, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, in a social media post describing the wildfires which are burning west of the capital, Athens. Theodore Genaros, who's a meteorologist and researcher at the National Observatory of Athens, says the risks are increasing and governments need to act quickly.
The broad picture is that we are seeing the price we are now paying, both for climate crisis but also for the decisions we have made over the past decades in terms of land management. On the one hand, we have climate crisis that creates an environment that is much more conducive to fire than ever before. But on the other hand, our decisions in the field of land management, the abandonment of rural areas, the lack of forest management, all these decisions have led us to the point we are standing today.
Our Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford gave us this update.
It's quite an uneven picture. So in some areas, the fires have been contained and suppressed. In some areas, they're reigniting. So there's a particular focus in the area to the northwest of Athens, where the biggest fires were raging over the past few days and where the very high winds, in some cases, gale force winds, were causing real problems, particularly because it was very difficult to get helicopters and light aircraft up into the air to drop water onto the flames, which, of course, is a key part of any attempt to suppress these wildfires. And indeed, we saw a fatal crash of two helicopters yesterday as they tried to douse the flames. Now, the winds have died back quite a lot, so that is a big relief for the firefighters who had been talking about the grueling conditions that they were facing. So it does seem that the worst of the fires have been contained, but still there are attempts to suppress them completely because they do keep reigniting. The wind is still a factor, and of course it is still extremely hot and the ground is extremely dry.
And Sarah, how else are the authorities reacting and what other measures are they having to adopt?
Well, the main focus is on trying to get planes and helicopters up into the air to be able to use them in this fight against the fire. I mean, lots of officials have been stressing how difficult it's been. They've said that there have been 220 separate fires recorded in the last week alone. They're also focusing on how those fires are started. So we know that there have been more than 30 people arrested for starting fires, either through negligence or in some cases suspected arson. So they're focusing on that. They're also focusing, of course, on evacuating people still when and if they come into any danger.
Well, in Hungary, high temperatures and low rainfall are putting extreme pressure on waterways. The Danube River has fallen to its lowest levels in 30 years, leading to the temporary shutdown of parts of the country's largest nuclear power plant, Paks. Water from the Danube is used as a coolant. Our correspondent in Hungary, Nick Thorpe, is following the situation.
We've been getting mixed signals about Paks. It turns out now that only three quarters or four fifths of the reactors have had to be closed down so far. We were told earlier that at dawn today, the fourth and final reactor had been closed down. These are 500 megawatt reactors. We've heard from the Prime Minister that the fourth and final reactor, they've closed down three. One of them is still functioning, but only at half capacity, I think, generating 240 megawatts. What that means, though, is that a large part of the energy supply, the electricity supply that Hungary depends on, has been removed from the grid. So we are facing major energy shortages here. There have been major attempts by the government, appeals from the government to companies, to industry and to the public to close down, not to use any excess energy. Just on Saturday, the public and the companies managed to reduce their use by 700 megawatts. So thanks to that, there haven't been compulsory blackouts yet, though that could happen later in the week.
Nick Thorpe reporting. Next to the remarkable story of baby Theo, who was operated on while in his mother's womb to correct a birth defect, which meant that his intestines developed outside his body. His mother, Maisie Savage, from London, was the first British woman to be operated on. She was 26 weeks pregnant. Theo was the third baby in the world to benefit from the new clinical trial. This report from Camilla Horrocks.
Maisie was 20 weeks pregnant when she and her partner, Josh, discovered there was a major problem with their baby, Theo.
We went in for our just the usual scan, check everything was OK. And the sonographer noticed that something wasn't quite right.
Theo had a condition called gastroschisis, which affects around 1 in 3,000 unborn babies in the UK each year.
Essentially, a lot of his bowel and intestines and his appendix were all growing on the outside.
The belly button doesn't develop properly, leaving the intestines to grow externally.
It was terrifying, wasn't it?
Yeah, incredibly scary.
Specialists at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London found that Theo had complex gastroschisis, which would have required multiple surgeries after birth, months in intensive care, and potential lifelong complications.
And then one Tuesday evening, we got a call.
We had a little girl come from Mexico.
This is Dr. Michael Belfort, a pioneering surgeon from Texas Children's Hospital who's been trialling experimental surgery for patients just like Maisie and Theo in the United States.
We have chosen that 15% of babies with gastroschisis that have the worst prognosis.
Theo's parents were told they qualified for the trial.
But the catch was that it was in Texas and that we would have to go there pretty much right away and we'd have to stay there for the remainder of the pregnancy.
At a hospital in Belgium, Maisie was given a Botox injection through her womb and into Theo's abdominal wall to relax the muscles to make the repair easier. Then the family flew to Texas, where the operation was performed 26 weeks into the pregnancy. Maisie's womb was partially exposed. The amniotic fluid was drained and replaced with CO2 gas to expand the operating space. Then, using keyhole surgery, Theo's organs were gently pushed back inside his abdomen, which was then stitched closed. The operation was a total success. Maisie went on to carry Theo to term. He was born by natural delivery, a perfectly healthy baby boy with no scar.
Oh, he's completely fine.
He's great.
He's amazing. Everything they did just completely reversed what could have been a really horrible start to his life.
The majority of paediatric surgeons...
Dr. Belfort is already looking ahead to what he can do next.
The inside of the uterus is now a new surgical space for innovation. Certain cardiac surgeries in utero... And I think we can do some lung surgeries in utero. So, you know, it's open for ethical experimentation.
This technique is undergoing clinical trials in the US involving 10 babies.
Talking.
Baby Theo is one of the lucky ones. His future has been completely turned around.
So strong.
His mum and dad, Maisie and Josh, feel incredibly grateful and are now finally enjoying parenthood.
The impact that they've had on us as a family is incredible. The level of care was amazing. They made a very traumatic time of our lives so much easier, and we've got this little man and we couldn't be happier.
He is a little miracle, isn't he?
He is. Yeah.
Camilla Horrocks reporting. Still to come in this podcast, we look back at the unusual techniques of the man known as the Horse Whisperer, who's died aged 91.
Well, what I watched was the horses communicating with the lions, the bears, the wolves. I'm more on that side of it, am I not? A horse decides to be with you instead of away from you.
This is the Global News Podcast. The detained former leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been allowed to meet a delegate from the International Committee of the Red Cross, her first confirmed contact with the outside world for 2.5 years. Ms. Suu Kyi, who's 81, has been in detention since her government was overthrown by the military 5 years ago. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Ms. Suu Kyi's son, Kim Aris, following the reports that she'd met the Red Cross official.
I spoke with that delegate earlier today. He confirmed that, and that my mother does appear to be in good health.
What else was he able to tell you about how she is?
I'm afraid very little. They're kind of bound by various agreements with the military, so they can't reveal too much. I believe that the pictures which have been released are real on this occasion.
And when was the last time you had any contact with your mother?
The last communication I had from her was at the beginning of 25, I believe it was. I received one letter, and that's the only communication I've had over the last 5 years. It's been tough, I must say. I've had to contend with being separated from my mother for many years. After all, she was under house arrest for 15 years. But the last 5 years have been different because we haven't known where she is or how she is or been allowed any communication, basically.
Has it been possible to assess how she might be doing from a mental health perspective or an emotional health perspective? Because she's very isolated, I think.
She is. And from what I've been able to gather, you know, over the last 5 years, she has been held in solitary confinement, essentially. And I'm sure that will be taking a toll. But to all appearances, she seems well. I know that she keeps a very strong routine in her life, and that includes meditation and exercise. I think that's managed to see her through a lot of hard times.
And in terms of you and the rest of the family, how do you cope with it?
I've had to deal with this for many years. After all, I was 12 years old, I think, when she was first put under house arrest, and I was actually with her at that time. So whilst I can't say that my situation is normal in any way, it has become kind of what I'm used to over the years.
Your family has got a very long political history, hasn't it? Some people listening may not be familiar with it. But are there any moments that you sort of question your mother's sort of devotion to that and whether she's made decisions which have been actually quite difficult to live with?
Not really. I've always realised that her path's not an easy one and that there always would be difficult choices to make and what have you. But I feel that the international media actually got it wrong on a number of points with my mother, and that there was a very misleading narrative put forwards surrounding her involvement with the Rohingya crisis. And that did a huge amount of damage. But I hope that that can still be rectified.
There was some criticism for the way that she handled that crisis when she was in power. What would you say?
People didn't really realise what she was contending with. It was a very fragile situation there. The democracy wasn't fully fledged. The military still had a huge amount of power, and they did not have to answer to my mother.
If you were able to address them, what would you say?
Well, I still call on them to release my mother and all political prisoners. After all, we all know that the charges are completely false, and to stop bombing their own people.
And if your mother was able to hear this broadcast, what would you say to her?
I'd send her my love, as always, and say we're always thinking of her and that I hope to see her before long.
Kim Aris. There are now more than 3,600 confirmed cases of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo, making it the biggest outbreak of the disease there. Dr. Maria van Kerkhove is the director of the Department of Epidemic and Pandemic Management in the Health Emergencies Programme of the WHO. She told Darshini David that a joint international effort was needed to deal with the outbreak.
There is intense transmission that we're seeing in Ituri province and Bunia, where I'm currently sitting. And there's a number of factors. Right now, this virus is in 49 health zones, and the scale of the response is not where we need it to be. We at WHO are working with a number of partners in response and in support of the government and having them lead this, but we're nowhere near where we need to be. Right now, we need a massive scale up, having enough beds. We have 900 beds right now, and we're scaling up to 3,000 at least. We're looking at a massive scale up of clinical care and having Ebola treatment centers in the areas where we know there's active transmission, but also in areas where we're seeing new cases. Community engagement is absolutely critical to work with communities to, first of all, come and seek care, to understand what this virus is, and so that we could protect them and their loved ones and have them work with us to protect them and their loved ones. So it's very, very complex.
What about the international community and the support you're getting from that? Some people have pointed to the dismantling of US aid in 2025 as being a factor in not being able to provide an adequate response.
Well, there are a number of factors that are leading to this. As you know, in this area, it's a massive humanitarian challenge that we see with insecurity, with challenges of not only Ebola, but there's other infectious diseases that are circulating. There's hunger. There are active groups that are here, armed groups that are here. And yes, international partners are really critical in terms of supporting the community, not only for Ebola, but for all of these other challenges, again, under the government's leadership. What we are asking for from the international community, we at WHO are here in the field, we're with many, many different partners. What we need to see right now is a massive scale up across all of the pillars of the response, and many partners are involved in this, and we need all of the partners to scale up as well. There are significant challenges to this outbreak, but there are concrete solutions that we can work together to actually stop this outbreak. Yeah, but it is going to take some time.
Yeah, we know that there are vaccines being worked on in Singapore and here in the UK as well. But in the meantime, what are the risks here? Because you say the pace of transmission is growing. What does that mean for the risks of transmission across the region and indeed globally as well?
Well, the risk of Ebola globally is low, and that is something that we know. In the area that we're in, we are certainly seeing an intensification of transmission, which is why we want this massive scale up that we've been talking about. But there are risks for spread. And so we are looking at the Ituri province. We're looking at North Kivu and South Kivu and other areas. And with our partners, we've actually mapped the risk of the provinces in the DRC, but also in neighboring countries. So there are a number of activities we are working with countries that are bordering the DRC in terms of readiness. And in fact, we're changing this word readiness to actually active response, because we want all of these countries on alert for potential cases to be identified.
Dr. Maria van Kerkhove of the WHO. The falling value of the Japanese currency had not only the government in Tokyo worried, but also the Americans. That's why, as both sides have now confirmed, they introduced joint moves last week to stabilize the yen, which had fallen to a 40-year low. President Trump called the move a signal of friendship, which also benefited the US and the world economy. I spoke to our Asia business editor, Maura Fogarty.
This was a very rare move, Ankur. Both the U.S. and Japan coordinated going in to support the Japanese yen from weakening even further. Now, we don't know the exact details of how they did this, but I will say that Reuters has a photograph of a notepad in front of U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent during a cabinet meeting on Friday, in which it says, to do by Japanese yen, $5 to $10 billion. That's the signaling that we have from the U.S. side. We know that from data from the Bank of Japan show that they spent about $59 billion on Thursday before the intervention, the joint intervention on Friday. So together, what they did was essentially try to buy Japanese yen in order to keep the yen at as high a level as they possibly can.
Now, what's happened to the yen to make it so weak?
There are several reasons for this. The biggest one being that many traders and investors around the world think that the Bank of Japan is behind and has been slow to raise interest rates in Japan compared to other central banks around the world. So the differential that you get, if you're putting your money into a Japanese bank, you're getting a 1% return, the benchmark rate I'm talking about, okay, not the actual bank rate. In the U.S., it's between 3.5% to 3.75%. So because of that differential, who wants to put their money in Japanese yen? And it's that that's also causing speculators to come into the market and say, hey, you know what? We think there's more downside risk. We think the Japanese yen can weaken even further.
And how do the measures benefit the U.S.? It's not the first time, actually, that they've helped Japan out. I recall back in 2011, they did the same thing.
They did, and they also did it in 1998 as well for different reasons. In 2011, after the big earthquake and tsunami, they actually came in to help the Japanese government weaken the yen. But the last time they helped to prop up the yen was back in 1998. There's a self-interest here, right? The Japanese government is the biggest holder of U.S. treasuries. And if they had to do it on their own, how would they sell the U.S. dollar and buy Japanese yen? They would do that by selling U.S. treasuries. And so what the U.S. does not want to see is U.S. treasuries being sold, because essentially what that means is it raises the cost of borrowing in the United States. It's not an act of charity. It helps out the U.S. as well.
Maura Vargati reporting from Singapore. The American horse trainer Monty Roberts, who developed a radical way of communicating with horses, has died age 91. Known as the horse whisperer, Monty believed that horses use a non-verbal language which humans can replicate. He explained his methods to BBC Outlook's Joe Fidgin in 2017.
I don't have a long neck. I don't have long ears.
You
I don't have four
ears,
legs. So how do I do it? Well, what I watched was the horses communicating with the lions, the bears, the wolves. I'm more on that side of it, am I not? I have fingers. So does a lion. I have a palm open to you right now, showing you my palm with the fingers open. No horse will approach you when you do that, because the lion is on the track. Eyes on eyes mean go away. Square shoulders means go away. I am dangerous. And then if you reverse those procedures and you close your fingers down, if you turn then and put your shoulders on a 45 and drop this arm that where I had my hand open down across your body, then the cat's asleep and they'll come walking to you. It's a element of my work called join up, where the horse decides to be with you instead of away from you.
Monty's fame grew when he met Queen Elizabeth, who was an avid horsewoman.
She read about me in some magazines that were done in the United States, and she was mesmerized by what she read there. Can't be. And she gave it to Sir John Miller, her equerry at the time, and said, read them and come back and give me a little thumbnail report on these two articles. And he came back and said, hogwash. It can't be done. And she said to this man, don't you have friends in California? He said, yes. And she said, I'll get you a ticket and you go to California and ask him to start some horses for you, work with some horses for you. And so he came over and watched me, and then he said, what are you doing the first week in April? And I said, whatever you say, and I was at Windsor Castle. I did 23 horses in 5 days for her personally. She said, it's amazing, it's a miracle.
Monty Roberts, the cowboy who became friends with the Queen. And that's all from us for now. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag GlobalNewsPod. And don't forget our sister podcast, The Global Story, which goes in depth and beyond the headlines on one big story. This edition of The Global News Podcast was mixed by Paul Mason, and the producers were Judy Frankel and Paul Day. The editor is Karen Martin, and I'm Ankur Desai. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.